great message. So did I. But, of course, it was a huge disappointment once again. He made a beautiful speech in Prague, and I guess we were all hoping something like that would happen. It didn't happen. It was a huge... Anyway...
Setsuko Thurlow, we want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO, Portland. The time is now 4:59 p.m. And coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Our nation's over-reliance on incarceration has left millions of children emotionally cut off from the most important relationship of their young lives. Join Prison Pipeline on May 30th to hear Laura Speer from the Annie E. Casey Foundation discuss how children of prisoners are impacted and how the states and communities can help support these kids and improve their prospects for success. That's Prison Pipeline, May 30th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a film premiere gala and fundraiser for Outside the Frame, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Outside the Frame is a new organization that empowers homeless and marginalized youth by producing films with youth that convey their life experience. They will premiere The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a riff on Peter Pan, where real lost boys and girls debate if and how to return to mainstream society. They will also screen original film shorts by homeless youth about issues such as drug abuse, gender identity, and the healthcare system. Again, that's The Lost Boys of Portlandia, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Staton retires.
The national parks are going corporate.
And Saudi Arabia uses 40-year-old British cluster bombs in Yemen. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 27th, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Staton announced to his staff today that he is retiring. Staton has been in hot water for months. First, he was accused of harassment by staff members. An investigation is ongoing by the state on those charges. Then he was accused of investigating members of the county's Charter Review Commission, which was tasked with deciding whether his job should be elected or appointed. Taking over for Staton will be former Portland Police Chief Mike Reese, who was sworn in as a replacement last month. Reese will become undersheriff of Multnomah County, which means he will be in charge of the county's sheriff's office daily operations. County Chair Deborah Cafori, who urged Staton to resign repeatedly, said in a statement today, quote, "This is not the time to rehash any issues about the sheriff. I'm looking forward, not back. But I want to reassure people who live there and visit that Multnomah County is committed to their safety and protection."
The Oregon Senate has confirmed Governor Kate Brown's nominee for the state's first ever state resilience officer. Michael Harriman will be the point person in charge of helping the state prepare for the effects of seismic activity predicted from the Cascadia subduction zone. The position was created by the Oregon legislature in 2015 to improve Oregon's seismic safety and resilience. In 2013, Oregon's Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission report said that much of Oregon's infrastructure remains vulnerable to a major seismic event. One of Harriman's first actions in office will be to attend the Cascadia Rising event happening from June 7th through the 10th. Harriman's job is to coordinate with various state and local agencies to make Oregon more resilient in the event of a major earthquake and tsunami. A U.S. Army and Oregon National Guard veteran, Harriman has served since 2012 as Director of Emergency Operations for the Oregon Health Authority.
An Oregon proposal that would raise the minimum tax on businesses earning more than $25 million in sales has qualified for the November ballot. The money raised from the taxes would go towards education, healthcare, and senior services, and top $3 billion annually. KBOO's Demi Hellenius reports in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
A proposal heading to the November ballot would raise taxes on the largest corporations in Oregon in order to fund education, healthcare, and senior services in the state. That proposal, Initiative Petition 28, would add $3 billion a year to the state's budget, according to an analysis by the Legislative Revenue Office this week. Lisa Fergala, a second-grade teacher in Eugene who worked with the group A Better Oregon to gain signatures, says schools are in desperate need of funds.
The services that have been cut have long ago reached a critical point, and now what we're looking at is a crisis, and I don't think we can wait any longer.
The proposal would increase the minimum tax on C corporations with sales of more than $25 million in Oregon to 2.5%. Last week, supporters turned in more than 130,000 signatures, 40,000 more than needed, to qualify the proposal for the ballot. Opponents argue the measure would place a big tax burden on companies doing business in the state. Fergala says this is simply a way for corporations to pay their fair share to institutions they already benefit from.
They get a lot of benefits, including educated citizens, good infrastructure in our state, and they can afford to contribute to making sure that we have the schools that our community needs.
The legislative analysis also found the proposal could affect the economy, causing the loss of about 38,000 private sector jobs by 2022. However, the analysis also points out 18,000 jobs would be gained in the public sector. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
Recent revisions to a director's order originally crafted in 1998 will permit corporations to advertise in places like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite as a way to make up for budget shortfalls as soon as next year. If approved, the National Park Service will be able to raise funds through its philanthropic partnerships to bridge the funding gap. But critics argue the move is contrary to the organizational charter of preserving natural spaces. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan discussed the developments with Jeremy Moeller from In the Public Interest. He explained why his organization believes the proposal should not be advanced.
The National Park Service is seeking to pad their budget by offering advertising opportunities to their corporate partners. These are companies like Coca-Cola and Disney. Do you believe that this overture is in keeping with the purpose of what the parks were established for?
Certainly not. I think that's a pretty simple no. The national parks were, of course, established over a century ago now. They're actually going through their centennial celebrations over the next few years in the past year or so. They were obviously set aside as public space that could be accessed by anyone, whether you were poor, whether you're wealthy, and also to set aside natural resources from exploitation by the private sector. So, and these are the most beautiful areas in our country. So to start putting advertising and other private influence in these public spaces for a number of reasons, which I can talk about, is certainly against that original mission.
If this proposal gets fully realized, can you share with our listeners what kind of differences they can expect when vacationing in these locales?
A number of things would change. One is that it allows, for the first time ever in the National Park Service's history, naming rights and logos within parks themselves. So the director's order is pretty explicit about what that would mean. For example, there could be anything from benches to entire buildings that could be sponsored by corporations or individual donors. You could also have park vehicles that are sponsored as well with logos on them. And then they also have something, they name it temporary signage, which is a very kind of broad phrase. So you could imagine signs in parts of parks that would basically be billboards for folks and donors that contribute to the Park Service. Visually, I think that would be the biggest effect. It doesn't actually allow for sponsorship and logos and advertising in the natural areas within parks, so you wouldn't see it like in the Grand Canyon itself, but in the areas where the visitor centers, parking lots, areas where people congregate in these parks, you could start seeing signs. And then outside of that, I'll also say that it actually works the other way around. So these donors, corporations, companies, et cetera, could start using national park symbols in their ad campaigns. So, for example, you could have a company like ExxonMobil that now, if this proposed plan goes through, would be allowed to run campaigns featuring national park symbols, images of national parks, say like a TV commercial would have an image or a video from a national park, and then they would be able to say that they're a good neighbor to this national park because it donated some money to enhance, say, wildlife habitat in the parks or whatever money they gave. ExxonMobil could now cozy up and have that sort of relationship with these national parklands.
Do you believe a corporate entity's environmental track record is relevant as criteria to be eligible for such a program?
We don't have a stance on this that we really kind of laid out, but I could say that basically the entire revision itself should not go through as is, because it essentially sets up a National Park Service that is a public-private sort of agency in terms of where its funding comes from. Currently, the NPS is funded by Congress, but then also from donations through the National Park Foundation, as I mentioned. This would just increase that pressure from the private side and decrease pressure on Congress and us as a public to actually invest in our national parks. So in general, I think we oppose the entire revision. I don't think we need actual stipulations within there. Now, if it is going to go through and there's no way to stop that, then of course we should be demanding that sort of stipulation.
The reason that I ask is I did go to the National Park Service website. I did find the list of their corporate partners. And with that information, I went and visited a website run by the Corporate Research Project. They have what's called a violation tracker. Mm-hmm. And the data available there suggests that two of these companies have been fined a total of $30 million for over 1,000 infractions since 2010. And this is for environmental health and safety infractions. If this is a place they decide that we have to go, speak to your belief as to whether or not such criteria should be part of the mix.
I totally agree with you, Robin. I would say it's not surprising because the National Park Service did work with Anheuser-Busch and InBev last year. And I believe the last time that there was a listing, and I'm not 100% aware of what organization put it together, but it's basically a top 100 air polluters in the United States listing. And the last time that was calculated, that company was number 41. And that's in there with energy companies, coal-powered plants, et cetera. Here's a beer company that's number 41, so they're pretty bad. That did not stop the National Park Service from working with them last year. So I 100% agree that is a good idea.
I've been talking with Jeremy Mueller with the group In the Public Interest. For more information, you can visit their website at inthepublicinterest.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy here in the Willamette Valley, with highs in the low 70s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, there's sunshine with clear skies in the evening. Today in history, in 1930, the Chrysler Building opened in New York City and was the tallest man-made structure at the time. The quote of the day comes from Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who said, quote, "The axis of the earth sticks out visibly through the center of each and every town or city."
It's 5:14. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
First came withering hoots of laughter when the honchos of George Mason University named their law school the Antonin Scalia School of Law. Yes, the acronym for that spelled A-S-S-O-L. An honor Scalia might have merited, but very embarrassing for the university. Even though administrators quickly changed the name to the Scalia Law School, their embarrassment turned into shame, for it turns out they had sold the naming rights to none other than multi-billionaire right-wing extremist Charles Koch. For years, Koch and other moneyed corporatists have quietly pumped millions into a couple of pseudo-academic centers on campus to promote their laissez-faire ideology. But here was Virginia's largest public university letting the infamous Koch brother and one other unnamed right-winger give $30 million in exchange for branding George Mason's law school, one of the university's core academic components, with Scalia's name. Students and faculty rebelled at the idea that the integrity of their university, supposedly a center of enlightenment and erudition, was to be identified with a judge notorious for veering into racist and homophobic rants, and for being the Supreme Court's most obsequious servant of plutocratic corporate rule. Rebellion turned to fury when it was learned that the right-wingers' quote, donation also required school officials to commit taxpayer money to finance 12 new professorships and 2 new centers to promote the Koch brothers' fantasies of free market plutocracy. This is Jim Hightower saying, the university's president calls this perfidious transaction a simple, quote, naming gift. But who is he to put the name of the People's Law School up for sale? And why was it sold in a secret no-bid process? Koch was not making a gift. He was buying a public asset, including the university's integrity.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court this week strongly repudiated the work of Georgia prosecutors who eliminated African Americans in the jury pool of a black man convicted of killing a white woman in 1986. The court ruled 7-1 in favor of Timothy Tyrone Foster, throwing out his conviction as well as the death sentence he had received 29 years ago. Observers say Foster will likely get a new trial. The court scolded state prosecutors for ignoring rules it laid out in 1986 to prevent racial discrimination in the selection of juries. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the court that Georgia prosecutors were, quote, motivated in substantial part by race, end quote, when they struck African Americans from the jury pool. The court did nothing to limit peremptory strikes, through which lawyers may strike potential jurors without offering any reason. Clarence Thomas dissented, saying he would have respected the decisions of the state judges who sided with prosecutors and rejected Foster's claims. However, Justice Elena Kagan said the case seemed as clear as a, quote, as a court is ever going to see.
Earlier this week, Amnesty International revealed that a military coalition led by Saudi Arabia has used 40-year-old British-made cluster munitions in Yemen, weapons manufactured in the UK in the 1970s. The Cluster Munitions Coalition is a coalition of organizations working to stop the use of cluster munitions around the world. KABU reporter Jamie Haddad spoke with Megan Burke, director for the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, one organization that's part of the Cluster Munitions Coalition.
The weapons that were used are weapons that are possessed and have been in the stockpiles of both Saudi Arabia and at least one other member of the Saudi-led coalition for many years. So there's no suspicion that these weapons were provided recently. They were produced in the 1970s by the United Kingdom and presumably purchased soon thereafter by Saudi Arabia. The use...
Sorry about that. We're experiencing some technical difficulties. You can hear that story about Yemen by going to our Facebook page at KBOO News, and you can hear a segment of that there. Moving on, after more than 2 months of regular demonstrations across France, opposition to a new labor law has intensified. Strikes and blockades at petroleum refineries began last week. This week, they spread to nuclear plants. The new wave of protests began after President François Hollande made a constitutional end run around Parliament and enacted the labor reform by decree. Tens of thousands took the streets of Paris again this week. Raphael Croft was there.
All together, General Strike chanted the demonstrators at a rally in Paris. They belong to the Confédération Générale du Travail, or CGT, the largest trade union in the country. The French government accuses the CGT of radicalization for organizing most of the ongoing blockades at refineries and, more recently, at nuclear power plants. But the CGT is not acting alone. They are joined by Force Ouvrière, another trade union. Manuel Valls, the French Prime Minister, says the blockades are illegal and justifies the use of force to evacuate them.
Parfois c'est légal quand il s'agit de manifester.
Demonstrating is legal, but blockades of fuel depots pose security and legal problems. Enough is enough. It's unbearable to see that happening. That's why our answer to the union's behavior will be extremely firm. We will continue to evacuate the fuel depots that are blocked by this trade union.
Police using water and cannons and tear gas are breaking up the blockades, while demonstrators are burning barricades and persist in protest. They say the real vandals are the state and the bosses. It's a real arm wrestling contest between a government not willing to change a single comma in the law and trade unions who seem ready to bring the country to a halt at the eve of the month-long European Soccer Cup set to begin here in early June. Noël Lechin is a representative of the Confédération Générale du Travail.
We are not radicalizing the movement. We have been calmly demonstrating for 2 months with very limited strikes to ask the government to come back to the negotiating table with trade unions. The government refused. So we just moved to a higher stage with the strikes and blockades so we will be heard. And if this doesn't work, we'll go even higher ahead of the European Soccer Cup.
Le Chien did not wish to be precise about what the higher stage might be. On Thursday, as many as one-third of France's filling stations were reportedly either out of gas or running low, and officials say they have dipped into strategic fuel supplies. But so far, rail transport has suffered little disruption, and strikes in nuclear plants will probably not provoke power cuts. According to recent polls, a majority of the French population supports either abandoning or revising the labor law. More than 60% hold the government responsible for the current blockades. And while voices inside the government indicate that the most controversial clause in the law undermining national agreements might be changed, Prime Minister Manuel Valls has rejected any such move. Raphael Kraft, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Jamie Haddad, and Demi Hellenius. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Engineering is Ian the Cool Gadbury. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. Coming up on Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, more talk radio is off. Instead, we'll hear Peace Talk Radio featuring veterans turning towards peace. Conversations with two U.S. military veterans who have chosen different paths for peaceful action in the years following their military service. At 9, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, hear Brian Terrell of Voices for Creative Nonviolence on Drones, S. Brian Wilson on Memorial Day, and his recent visit to Vietnam, and a discussion of the life and work of Sandra Bland. And at 10, we begin the broadcast of all 8 hours of D.M.A. Roberts' award-winning series, Crossing East, the first and to date only Asian American and Pacific Islander history series on public radio. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Liam.
Good night, Jenna.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, federal regulations work overtime to kill American prosperity. Well, you see what they did there. That's Reason Magazine on new Labor Department rules that mean more people will get overtime pay when they, well, work overtime. We'll get a different take from Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute. Also on the show, hundreds of thousands of people around the world took to the streets last weekend in protest of Monsanto, the corporate giant that's one of the big six dominating the world's seed, pesticide, and biotechnology industries. Their anger had to do with much more than the labeling of GMO food. We'll hear about that from Patty Lovera of Food and Water Watch. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press. Presidential elections have a way of bringing to surface some core tenets of corporate media's conventional wisdom. One such pearl was expressed by David Shribman, a former New York Times political writer, now executive editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, in a May 21st Times op-ed. It's about what Shribman calls Clintonism, the political creed that defined Bill Clinton's presidency. Quote, celebrated by its supporters as a synonym for peace, prosperity, and a common-sense centrism, Clintonism was and is still derided by its detractors on the left as corporatism and on the right as a shorthand for scandal and impeachable offenses, close quote. Say what you will is the upshot. Clintonism was an effort to pull the Democratic Party, which had lost 5 of the 6 presidential elections between 1968 and 1988, back into political relevance. And even though when he left office, many liberals felt bruised, quote,